Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything crypto, DeFi, and all that is in between. If you want to know what's going on in the world on chain, well, you've come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave here with Capital K, and we are here to help you harness the power of the flywheel. And this time around, we go into the wonderful world of RWAs slash tokenized assets, perf dexes, and we put them together to create Ostium, which is a RWA perp dex coming to you soon, TM. We have on Calidora, who is the founder, and we really get into it. We really get into the nitty gritty details on how it works, what the exchange is, how the oracles work, how the funding rate works, how settlement works, how market make. We go into like every little detail of Ostium, and we go into some more. She has quite the interesting background, right, Kit?
Perpification. That's it. One comment. Perpification.
Yeah. Move out of the way, tokenization. Perpification is in the chat. Or like that meme, like, yo, silence tokenization. Perpification is speaking.
Yes. Say that quickly 5 times. You know.
Perpification. And let's get into perpification. And before we do, make sure you go ahead, give us a like. Hit that bell button, subscribe to our YouTube, leave us a comment, let us know what you think. Follow us on all of our socials on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram at Flywheel DeFi. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22.
You can follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And let's get the flywheel spinning. Flywheel. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here as always with Capital K. And this time around, we get into the perpification of RWAs. We have on Calidora of Ostium, the founder of Ostium, which is a RWA perp dex that is on Arbitrum, launching soon, TM. Calidora, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me. Super excited to chat.
Yeah, before we get into it, you probably have one of the more interesting stories, if not like the most interesting story I've seen in recent memory in crypto, going from professional ballerina all their lives to starting a RWA perp dex. I'm just curious, what's your background? How'd you get started building? And in terms of being a ballerina, what's one thing people wouldn't expect when it comes to being a ballerina? Like something that people don't think about when it comes to it?
That's a great question. I like how you framed it. Okay, so I guess I'll give the brief overview of how I got here, and then I'll give you an answer to your question about being a ballerina. Ballet was my first love. I started dancing when I was 3. I spent my whole sort of young life thinking that was all I was ever going to do. I was lucky enough to be able to, I guess, achieve that dream or get close to that dream, your like childhood dream in the true sense of the word. After I graduated high school, I danced professionally for 5 years. I danced first with Boston Ballet for 1 year and then the Royal Danish Ballet in Denmark for 4 years. So moved, abroad to Copenhagen, spent some pretty formative years there, learned Danish, integrated, I guess, locally.
Wow. You learned Danish. Danish hard?
I speak like 5 languages. So I didn't like Danish was insanely hard for me because I speak German. So it's not like it is certainly quite distinct, but I think German is probably the language that besides like obviously Swedish and Norwegian, which are incredibly similar and I can like mostly understand.
Is Danish like German where like you can like create words and add things on to the end of words?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit less, there are fewer like composite words in German. Like I love that in German, you can just create if you wanted to say like carrot, apple, beet, pea soup, like that becomes one word. Those are not separate words. So it just becomes like a composite word. There's not as much of that in Danish. It's definitely more than in English, but the words are not nearly as long. The funny thing about Danish, and like here I have to stop me at some point because I love talking about languages. It's like my hobby obsession is like linguistics and languages. I like love finding the patterns. I almost find it's kind of like, deciphering the algorithm of like, especially once you know one language, figuring out
deciphering
the conversion
the
from one
algorithm
language to
of
another.
Reality.
Exactly. Of language and the evolution of communication. Like I took a couple linguistics classes in college and they were like some of my favorite classes. Although everything I know about language is sort of, I taught myself or is like mostly autodidactic or just because of exposure at a young age. What is this about Danish is the weird thing about the Danish language is you don't pronounce like most of the letters. So, and a lot of the letters that you, you know, it's written in normal like Latin script, but a lot of the letters mm-hmm. have a very different sound. So like H-E-D at the end of a word is hill. Like the D is that they call it a soft D. It's an L. One of my favorite examples, if anyone listening has ever been to Copenhagen and you've taken the subway, you've probably, if you've taken the M1 or the M2 subway in Copenhagen, you probably will have passed by the stop Amma if you're coming from the airport, which is Amma. Any guesses on how that's spelled? It's A-M-A-G-E-R. So the G-E-R is silent. and there are a lot of examples like that. Like, D, soft D, L example, like a good example is the word for apartment is Leijhil, which is spelled like L-E-J-L-I-G-H-E-D, which is not at all how you think you would spell that. So anyways, Danish is a great language.
Linguistics to your resume too.
You need to.
I'm like a total language nerd. Always in search of my next language. I haven't like accomplished a non-Proto-Indo-European descent language at all yet. So there'll be probably some, maybe like an Arabic or something in my future. We'll see. But not now. Don't have much time for learning a new language.
Five languages. So obviously English, German, yes. Danish. What are the other two?
French. So I grew up going to the French school as a kid. I went to the Lycée Français. So everything is in French from like maternelle, from when you're a child to when you graduate high school. So all of my math and physics and chemistry and everything was in French. So I remember like when I took the SAT, it was very confusing because we learned math in a different order. Think like math would be that anyone who's done school, like in a different linguistic system can probably empathize with this. It's very confusing when you have to take like American standardized tests because I was never in the American system until I went to college, which I didn't start until I was 23. So, my Spanish is, well, anyone can test me. My Spanish is not the best right now. It's been a while since I, it's okay, it comes back very quickly. So, anyways, so that's that story. Moved to Denmark, did dance there professionally for 4 years. I'd always had a sort of strong intellectual curiosity. I like skipped a grade. I graduated high school when I was like 16. So I sort of like always thought school was interesting or thought, and that's a very vague way of describing like general intellectual pursuits, but I was sort of all in on ballet and all in on focused on that. And I sort of didn't even want to apply to college because I saw it as like a weak move to need a backup plan. I was like so myopically focused on ballet, but at the smart encouraging of my parents, who were like, please, for the love of God, like just try to apply to a college, like just one, like apply to one and see what happens. I wound up applying to like three schools when I was my senior year of high school. I got into Harvard, and I had a moment of like, okay, never thought I would get into Harvard. Like maybe I should consider this. I went for this. This was like before my ballet career started when I was still in high school. Yeah. I went for the admitted students weekend, and I remember meeting so many brilliant people, like a world champion in like fencing, some professional ballroom dancer, some math Olympiad kid. Like I remember being so impressed by the kids that I met at like that admitted students weekend. It completely changed my perspective about like what school or what like a gathering of excellence could be. I had mostly just been, the examples of excellence that I was familiar with in high school mm-hmm. were mostly just ballet related. And so after that weekend, I decided to at least defer from Harvard because I was too young to audition for ballet companies because I was 16. So I deferred from Harvard for a year, trained for 1 more year, auditioned for ballet companies, got my job at Boston Ballet. And that's when I tried doing Harvard and Boston Ballet at the same time. That didn't last very long. It lasted about 7 weeks before dropping out. And then that's when I spent like the next 5 years of my ballet career. So there's a little bit of like Harvard in there very briefly before I dropped out. But then I just focused on ballet since that had always sort of been the plan. And at some point over the course of those 5 years, I realized that my brain was starting to rot and I, thought it might be atrophying and I should probably start like reading more and maybe think about going back to school. And I hit this inflection point like sort of in 2018, 2019. And I made the choice at the end of that ballet season, which the seasons go from like August to June. I made the choice at the end of that ballet season to retire at the ripe age of 23. It was sort of definitely considered like an unusual choice because things were going quite well. I was sort of hitting my stride in my career. But my calculus was if I ever want to do anything else and try to be really good at it, I need to start now because anyone who's tried to do anything that's at a high level knows it takes know, there's the 10,000 hours quip. I think it's a lot more than that. It's like, you know, probably double or triple that, and like years of effort and focus and precision, et cetera. And I had effectively sort of like made, I saw it as like a branching, like a branch tree, like a decision of, do I want to do this or some version of ballet for the rest of my life, choreograph, direct, whatever it is, or do I want to do something else? I came to the conclusion I wanted to at least take the leap, and I had no idea what it was going to be, but I wanted to see if I could ever be, if I could be something else beyond what I had conceived of, like my sole identity as a child. And so I retired kind of with like, I mean, to go back to Harvard, but with no plan about like what direction I would go in beyond like a vague interest in the markets and like a vague interest in biology because of like, you know, the body and being an athlete, et cetera. So I went back to school in 2019. I like retired on a Thursday, started school on a Monday. So I like didn't give myself a single second to process like quitting or retiring from the thing that I've been doing since the age of three that had been my whole identity. Much longer podcast to talk about my whole identity crisis and like how I came out of that. But
it'll be the next one. The next one.
Yeah. The next one. The first 6 months were pretty tough. I didn't really give myself space to process intentionally because I wasn't really sure what I would like find if I gave myself space to process, like not knowing what my identity was anymore. And I just went full speed ahead with school, started with summer school and then started the school year. And my first week of freshman fall, I was sort of in econ class. I was taking all the intro classes again. I lived in a freshman dorm again in a bunk bed, with two 17-year-olds. In the yard, taking the intro classes. I did the, I had to redo the like new freshman student, like orientation. So I had to have like, there was a 19-year-old showing everybody how to pour like fake alcohol into a solo cup that I had to listen to. It was just like a very jarring when you had like, it really was like when you've had 5 years of being an adult and like you moved abroad by yourself and you've been living by yourself and sort of being an adult for, you know, years, it's jarring to like go back and have a dining hall and be in a dorm and all that stuff. So that was definitely a readjustment. During that process, like the first week of school, I wound up meeting a very brilliant freshman named Marco, who now is my co-founder. He was 17 at the time. We were in econ class. Both of us were very loud and opinionated in that class and very excited about the topic for different reasons. I think like I was just elated to be learning again. And he was, I guess, elated to be continuing to learn perhaps. and he's like a sort of math and physics kid. He did math, physics and like bio Olympiads when he was in high school. That's sort of what got him into Harvard. He's from Portugal originally. And had sort of a history of doing that and had a latent interest in the markets that I guess he was starting to explore in college or both were just starting. And that's sort of, that's the beginning. That's like the beginnings of Austin, I guess, is like us meeting in that econ class and chatting. I think we stayed after the first class and talked for like 4 or 5 hours. For the first time we had a real conversation, we talked for that long. It was like in an exam review session that we had our first real conversation. And then both of us were spent a couple of summers basically working at different hedge funds. I spent one summer working for a fund called Verdad doing equity research. I spent another summer working at Bridgewater under one of the CIOs doing research on inflation. He also spent a summer there doing research on commodities. And throughout this sort of whole process, slowly and then all at once, we like fell down the crypto rabbit hole. I remember that, the first thing I bought was Bitcoin, I guess, like everybody else. I honestly can't even, I think like the first time I heard about crypto was like through one of my former classmates. Shout out to her. If she ever hears this, she'll probably
shout out her.
Know who she is. She was my original class. So before I dropped out, which is the 2018 class, she had done something, almost everybody went into like banking or consulting, and she joined a early stage crypto startup, I guess, in the sort of like she did a summer during the 2017 wave, at a company called Kaiko, the data company based in France. And she moved to Paris and from afar, having no understanding of the industry, she seemed like she had sort of speed run the like process of doing like having ownership in a way that everybody who'd kind of like gone down the standard like banking and consulting route had not. So I had this very vague sense of like, this seems like an industry that's moving very quickly and like seems ideologically aligned with my views as like relatively libertarian and whatever. And then during COVID, I guess used my stimulus check to buy Bitcoin. And then on Coinbase, but I started buying other stuff. And then Marco and I just like started training together, playing around in DeFi. We started reading white papers, you know, putting money in all the wrong protocols, having zero understanding of what the underlying was doing.
Wait, can you name names? What did you play around with?
Oh, I mean, I talked about this with like the exit liquidity guys. We both like bonded over the fact that we had like been exit liquidity for people and like Anchor and Luna. I didn't put a ton of money in because I didn't have that much to play around with, but that was a zero. And then I don't know, there were a couple about like Loop Ring at the top. I don't even know what the investment thesis was. I bought it at like
paying your dues.
We became so at some point it was like November 2020 or something. I think we were like, or 2021, we were like so reckless during this, like that fall for summer. We were just like buying, we were like daring each other to buy stupid. That was also zero.
Oh, you're not going to buy this.
So that, you know, we just sort of fell down the rabbit hole. I don't know how else to put it. Then after school, I was supposed to take my full-time role at Bridgewater, and he was supposed to continue with his like senior role with his senior year at school. And we very masochistically decided that we would like just take the leap without any like real sort of plan to try to build in crypto. We moved into a hacker house. We're like organized a hacker house with some other kids from MIT and Harvard in Cambridge, and sort of were there for, I think we were like there for 9 months. And over the course of that period, we went from like sort of no plan idea to going through Alliance, the accelerator, were definitely like the earliest stage company in the accelerator when we did it, to putting together a prototype, validating some of our market, like our theses on the market, and then raising a seed round, and then starting to hire a team. So all of that happened over that period of time we were in the hacker house, which was very fruitful. And then, you know, since then we've been building heads down and launched the V1, the first version of the testnet, alpha in November, went back to the drawing board and redid a lot of our infrastructure and launched the new version of the testnet, I guess the beta in March. And then we just launched our mainnet vaults in the full system trading, all engines go. We'll be launching very, very soon, maybe within the timeframe of when this podcast is released. We'll see. That's the very long story. This is like probably the longest intro I've ever given on a podcast.
No, we love it. It's great. Honestly, it makes more sense. When doing research for this, I noticed you like literally create words out of nowhere. Like one thing you said was in an interview was tokenization's overhype, perpivization is underhype. Did I say that right?
Perpification. That was my
perpification.
If you go far enough back in my tweets, there's one tweet that was like, you need to be Wordsmith maxing, like you need to be a modern Shakespeare, you need to be coining idioms, and like,
well, that's what I do.
I really believe in that. I think you need to be Wordsmith maxing. I subscribe to that.
But yeah, that statement, tokenization overhyped, perpification underhyped, can you go into it? Like, what did you mean by that, and like, what does it have to do with Ostium?
Yes. Okay. So the consensus view on real world assets, well, I mean, even going further back, right? Like, I think if this whole thing is going to work, like it will become blockchains will become the financial settlement layer for financial transactions and financial activity, and also other sorts of activity that become financialized. So for that to happen, there's an entire world of like hundreds of trillions of value that do not exist in any way on blockchains and are settled on other rails today that will need to migrate. I think we're obviously creating new value on, sorry, one second. Let me just restart that because I need to tell Marco not to call me in the middle of a podcast. Give me one sec.
Marco on podcast.
Okay. All right. Maybe you guys will cut that. Maybe you won't. So going back to the drawing board, I'll start from the beginning on that point. So in general, taking a step back, if all of this is going to work, if blockchains are going to work and become the financial settlement layer for all transactions or for all sorts of activity that becomes financialized in some way, there will need to be migration of the hundreds of trillions of dollars in value, in transaction volume that occur not on blockchains today onto blockchains today. And part of that is creating like net new value. And I think that's mostly what we've done, which is creating this sort of like net from the ground up new ecosystem ourselves and new forms of value through tokens. But we would be making a huge mistake to ignore all of the other stuff that's currently, that is a clear source of value, whether that's foreign exchange trading, whether that is commodities, whether that is equities or indices, whatever. There are many forms of value that exists that are not on chain that will, if we're going to succeed, will migrate in some way on chain. And the predominant consensus view on how that will happen in the path is tokenization, which I would broadly characterize as sort of taking the Circle or the Tether model that has worked for stablecoins, and then now has been extended in some form to treasuries. And I am for sure oversimplifying, but largely I would characterize as having some off-chain holding company that holds some asset, having some minting and redemption process, and then the generation of some token, like an ERC-20 token in the case of EVM chains, that represents that underlying asset that can be freely traded, transacted, and then redeemed in some form through some, either the same or some other off-chain entity for the underlying asset. And so you get like proof of reserves and ensuring those things are actually fully backed. But like that is the whole, like that is the way that those assets will be onboarded. I think that makes a lot of sense, obviously, for stablecoins or for other assets where you either want, like you need to use the actual token version for as like a means of exchange, which is obviously the case in stables, or as like a store of value. So if you want to sit on, a yield bearing treasury, and have that accumulate, yield or whatever it is. But I would argue that actually for most other assets, at least given the current profile of users on chain and where we see the most activity and where we see product market fit, which is largely in exchanges and trading, and especially on the non-spot side in perpetuals, it makes a lot more sense. And you better, like for a few reasons, you like better service the needs, the sort of like needs of existing users on chain. You, it's more scalable, and you also can better leverage like crypto native primitives that like the space has developed. If you do this through what I would call perp first approach, and this is where this little tongue in cheek term perpification comes in, which is my alternative term that I'm trying to make a thing. Maybe it'll be the Gretchen name of like, stop trying to make fetch happen. Like it's never going to happen, but I believe perpification is going to happen. That like this sort of perp first approach is for the reasons I just described, like more scalable, better suits the needs of users, and like better leverages crypto native primitives. And that, that's not to say that I don't think that there will be a tokenized form of gold or oil, or I mean, for gold that already exists. I think Pax Gold and others are an example. I recently wrote a piece on it, if you want to share it in the show notes. But for oil, for many equities or indices or, various FX pairs, actually mostly what people want to do is they want to punt on it. They want to bet on where it's going to go in the short term. They want to trade on it, and they don't need to sit on some tokenized version of it that is like necessarily composable and they can go and put everywhere else in DeFi. And so we think actually of this like bootstrapping of the perps market first before the spot market exists on chain is sort of the way these assets will move on chain first. And it'll be complemented by a tokenized version, which then can be eventually used as collateral, for instance, for opening up, you could use Pax Gold to open a position on like a gold perp or something and extend that to any other asset. So, that's sort of my vision. That's where I think things will go. That's how I think the first instance of Copper or the Hang Seng Index or whatever, any of these other assets, like they will first exist on chain in a perpified form, not in a tokenized form.
So for all the things to perpify, why RWAs and what RWA assets are you most excited about?
So I'll start by just saying, I think RWAs are, and many have pointed this out. I think Kyle from Multicoin was probably the most recent one who had a tweet that blew up about this, about how RWAs are a horrible term. I would agree. I just don't, I think it's like the worst, it's like that Churchill quote about democracy.
Yeah,
it's like the worst thing except for all the others.
Yeah, I just did a panel at ETHCC when I met you at the last Sparn. I did one about RWAs and I couldn't even get a sentence out. I literally said RWAs. And then like Mark Zeller just said, like, I fucking hate this term. This is a horrible term. We should call it tokenized assets. And like for 5 minutes, if people are like, yeah, this is an awful term, blah, blah, blah. And like, it is an awful term. It is an awful term. I agree.
Yeah. It also like means in traditional finance, when like non-crypto people see that, they think like risk-weighted assets. Like it doesn't mean real world assets. Also real world implies like it's not what we're doing. Crypto is like not real. So not my alternate proposal is I don't like tokenized assets either because it cuts out, perpified assets.
Right.
But I would say, my sort of tongue-in-cheek proposal is like off-chain, on-chain, off-chain assets, OCOCA, which doesn't really have the same ring to it. OCOCA. OCOCA sounds cooler, but
this is a linguist podcast now, guys.
Yeah, this is a linguist.
I told you I'm coining terms, I'm wordsmith maxing. I don't know if that one's going to take off. I think I'm not going
to
bet on that one. Yeah. Someone should open up a Polymarket bet for what will become the dominant term to describe non-digital assets coming on chain. Like non-digital assets. NDA. I don't really like. Okay, you know what? I'm going to say maybe we're not going to do. I think that that's not going to work. All right, I'm going to have to think of some more acronyms. But yeah, RWAs are canceled until we come up with a better one. So yeah, so why reward? Coming back to the question, what reward assets? this is like rapidly becoming a linguistics podcast. So we're focusing on FX commodities, so energy, metals, and soft commodities, as well as indices from day one. So that'll be the first set of assets that we have online. On testnet today, we have 19 assets. Two of those are crypto assets powered by Chainlink's data streams. That's Bitcoin and ETH. And then the other 17 assets are all powered by sort of in-house Oracle with like node operation run by Stork Network. And those pairs, I'll just read them out to you. There's some entertaining ones that might bring a smile to your face. So beyond the three G10FX, we have like Euro, Pound, and Yen. We have five metals. We have gold, silver, palladium, platinum, and copper. Copper is, I think, like a huge unlock for us. We're very excited about copper because it's usually used as like a signal betting on GDP expectations. On the energy side, we have WTI oil, Brent oil, and natural gas. And then we have two indices. We have international indices. We have Nikkei and Hang Seng. And then we have a series of more mutable commodities, lean hogs, live cattle, soybeans, and cocoa. So those will be released in phases on mainnet. I want to just caveat, I think like we've had a lot of data to observe the performance of all of those feeds and see which ones we think are like safe from day one to bring on mainnet. We also don't want to split liquidity among too many pairs. But the dream that we've had since day one has been if you can bring lean hogs, if you could trade pork on the blockchain, that'll be a massive unlock. And that is currently possible, at least on our testnet. So there's the assets we started with. To answer the question of like why, I mean, the FX is straightforward, right? Like there's a huge FX trading market. You've seen examples of FX being listed on some perps exchanges within the space already. And I think that's definitely where we've seen like the most activity and volume. Not to mention the fact that like the sort of like retail or consumer FX trading market out of crypto is huge. On the commodity side, the metals are they trade very similarly to FX. So those are fairly straightforward to onboard. And obviously you see a lot of demand for gold, especially on the energy side. We just picked both forms of oil and not gas as well. The soft commodities, the new ability. So the North Star is every liquid asset on Earth will be traded as a perp, and that'll happen through Ostium.
All your liquid assets belong to us.
Correct. Yes.
And all of these liquid assets are obviously going to need their own oracles, right? And right now you guys run all of them kind of internally. I guess the next question to kind of ask is like, since Oracle is literally what makes Ostium tick, like, can you walk through how they work? Kind of where do you pull the data? How do you account for like, market hours being on or off, rollovers, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I love talking about oracles. So I'll start maybe more simply like high level about oracles and sort of how they work and what they are and the different models for anybody who maybe is less well-versed in that specifically. So there's two primary oracle models, there's push and pull. There's also some hybrid, but I'll stick to the simple version. The push model is sort of the standard oracle model where at some regular cadence, whether that's defined by, timestamp every hour, every 10 minutes, every 30 minutes, or some change, like price deviates 50 basis points or price deviates 1 basis point, whatever it is, the data is by default pushed on chain. That model worked really well for a time, but as we got more high performance applications in DeFi, that became unsustainable due to the speed of updates that was required in order to do things like especially leverage trading or some lending applications. And so we've seen largely over the last 2 years a transition to the other primary Oracle model, which is the pull model, where data by default does not live on the destination chain. It either lives sort of off chain among some network of nodes or on some source chain, which I guess at the limit sort of maybe become the same thing depending on how like centralized the source chain is. And then are relayed to the destination chain, be it Arbitrum or Optimism, wherever you're deployed, and are brought there when there's a request, basically. So a request from that chain for the price, and that price is then pulled and included in some transaction or just posted on chain. The pole model is obviously the one that we need given our architecture and the structure of the application. And so I'll digging deeper into sort of the pole model. We consider, at least the way we conceptualize it when we built out our architecture, is that it's relatively modular. So there's different components and those components are modular. So the five core components, at least from our perspective, but we might sort of outline that differently, but at least for architecture are, so how do you source the data? Where does it come from? Is it from, you know, the CME or something, or is it from, you know, some third party? Is it from a market maker? Is it from, you know, your own trades? Where are you getting the data? Is it from Yahoo Finance? Where's the data coming from? How do you aggregate it? Are you medianizing it? Are you averaging it? Are you, you know, doing a median with outlier exclusion? How often do you calculate a price? Are you generating a price? How many of the, what's the minimum number of data? Is it three data providers out of five or five out of seven? How many of them need to report a price within a second or within 500 milliseconds for you to say, okay, I'm generating a price? So that sort of algorithm around price generation. Then there's assuming you're running all of this logic in parallel across nodes. And I recognize that that's not always the case for every Oracle. Some Oracles will have like one data provider per node. In our model, we have all data providers per each node. So assuming you're running this logic in parallel, how do you decide which node is right? Like what is the correct price? If all of the nodes are generating a price, what's the correct one? Which one do you pick? Or how do you average it? How do you aggregate across it? Then there is like, what is the final structure of the report that you emit? So what's included in that metadata? Does it include like, is it just a mid price? Is there a bid and an ask? Is there a market hours info? Like what is in that? And then the last piece is, okay, once it gets on chain, how do you verify it? And when we looked at like, what are we good at? Where do we have an earned secret? And actually not just where do we have an earned secret, but like, where do we need to do this ourselves? Because it does not exist anywhere. It was like, we need to like sourcing the data, how you aggregate the data and the structure of the price report. And we didn't have any, not to say that we don't have maybe things to add here, but I wouldn't say we're, you know, necessarily going to be geniuses at exactly what is the right way to pick the right, you know, the right report from some set of nodes. There's also so much like open source, there's a lot of like open source stuff to pull from to decide what that sort of like consensus should look like, as well as the verify contract. So how does this all come together? So all of the core part is like sourcing the data, finding new sources that are able to, that don't have licensing constraints, that are also real time and reliable, that can source you data for the underlying market for like gold or oil or whatever it is. The aggregation algorithm. So over what time period do you aggregate the data? Like how do you exclude outliers? This is like super, super important when it comes to things like commodities or assets where there's some role in the future where maybe you're like, you're referencing some rolling front month. So what happens in like the 10 days before expiry? How do you handle when half your data providers are referencing, you know, the August contract and the other half are referencing the September contract? So how do you deal with that without having these jumps? And then the last part where we had like a clear opinion was, okay, the structure of the price report, like what should it include? Should it include market hours? Should it include which contract you're referencing and all of that? Mm-hmm. Like bid and ask spreads, et cetera. So the rest of it, we then basically have Stork Network, which we work very closely with, operate the sort of nodes and handle the aggregation. So they have much more experience. They're a high performance Oracle with experience. You know, they serve a lot of the sort of professionals or a lot of the customers with high performance applications on many different chains. And they basically operate nodes in sort of an aggregator to ensure that it's like tamper free, that it also introduces decentralization because they have many different partners that operate nodes. And so we don't want to run that in-house. We think it's a centralization risk. We think it's not the right thing to do. So we have a partner that operates and sort of manages, does the node management and operation through their network. But the sort of logic of how that aggregation should work and the sourcing of the prices is something that we sort of came up with and architected. So I've been talking for a while. Hopefully that answers your question on the Oracle side.
Let me summarize really quick. Effectively, there are two types of Oracles, push and pull, and the one you guys use specifically is pull. And then there's with like five components that you guys really focus on. First being the source, and then second is kind of how you aggregate everything. And I think I missed the third one, but the fourth
the
one
third
is
how you get to consensus across nodes. Like how
to get to consensus.
Agree,
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is what information do you actually put out?
right? Market hours, yes. Mid-price, like you got to choose. And then lastly is, as always, verify. Those are the five components that goes into making your guys' Oracle. And on top of that, you guys are so good and so true to the ethos of crypto that you don't want to run all of these in-house and become a centralization risk. You work with the Stork Network to have like a ton of these nodes to kind of run the actual, you know, pulling of the data, but all the logic and all the formulas, everything is built by you guys. So you guys can truly trust it.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Okay, perfect.
So that's an excellent summary and way less long-winded than what I said. And I would say also that we... There we go. Yeah, I was going to say that like the moving towards like a as decentralized and as like trustless and like trust minimized and bias risk free model as possible is really important to us, right? Because otherwise we're just sort of replicating the market structures of the underlying markets, which, right, we don't want to do.
And to add to that, so just last point is like these oracles today feed, you know, Ostium's markets, but it could very much feed any other market that wants to come in and put like a UI layer on top, right? So
that's, yes, that yeah, in theory. So that's not, so it's something we've thought a lot about. And I think we've sort of, I think like the relative benefits to being able to list these feeds exclusively today are like much greater. I would also just add that, and this is sort of a broader, I think, discussion of just like DEX architecture. It's not as simple as just plugging in a feed for this stuff into your own perp stacks, because there's a lot that you need to do to account like at the architecture level for the properties of those assets. Mm-hmm. So just because you have some information about the market hours in your price report doesn't mean that you know how to handle it. How do your smart contracts know what to do with it? How do they account for those closures? Like, you know, how is that reflected in the trading experience? That's just one example. There are many others. It's not as simple as just plugging it into a normal herp stacks, but there's sort of two core like hurdles to getting these assets on chain. It's like actually getting the feeds and then like integrating the information that they provide in a way that accounts for the features of the underlying markets. And the devil's like really in the details. Like, you know, you could have something that works like 99% of the time, but then around, you know, market one news time, when like the spreads blow out, there's like some huge, you know, like that. So yeah, it's all sort of a nascent field or area of like knowledge within DeFi that is very, very, very specific.
And we glossed over the third point, but like consensus is a really key piece too, and how you stop the collusion, because literally oracles hinges, like your whole product hinges on these oracles coming in correct, right? They got to come correct. And could you share a bit about like the consensus model and how you get to like the consensus price? That's arguably the most secure part.
Yeah, so this is something that Stork is honestly better equipped to talk about, because we basically, when we looked at like partners in terms of like, you know, where do we have earned secrets and where do we need to do something? Where do we need to write the code ourselves versus like, where can we rely on an expert that actually knows more about this than us? We definitely relied sort of more on Stork on their, because they have an existing offering for their normal crypto feeds with other customers that they have their own sort of consensus mechanism for. So they're better equipped to talk about it. I can give like a brief overview, like high level. There's basically, there's like an election process across nodes because we needed to shift. As opposed to there being a median, you can do a median across nodes if all the nodes are just providing numerical information. But because our nodes also include non-numerical information, which is like whether the market is open or not, how do you medianize? Like, you know, if market open or not is like a zero or one, and you have like, you know, two nodes that are zero and two nodes that are one, getting a 0.5 is like an unintelligible information that's like not intelligible. It doesn't tell you anything useful. So you can't have like a pure median. So there's an election process. And that's probably all about it. To be honest, like I don't want to say the wrong thing. Yeah. So that they would be the better person to give you more accurate detail on the precise election process.
And so oracles aren't just used for pulling information. They're also used for settlement. When I was like looking into Ostium, it's not like there's an order book that settles straight. It's the oracles themselves that settle them. Can you go into how settlement like works with trades on Ostium?
Yeah, so I'll maybe structure this more as a response around the structure of the pool and the overall like liquidity model. So, okay, so I'll start with background, which is like, if you want to bring soybeans on chain, the universe of market makers for soybeans or like market making activities for soybeans on EVM chains is currently zero. So, and the market makers of soybeans are not active on EVM chains, or the people who know how to market make soybeans effectively are not EVM chains. So we, in order to be able, like being able to list longer tail assets and be a pioneer in onboarding new assets is so critical and like core to the, I think, like vision and North Star, that we wanted a model and we thought the only viable model given the current state of the market and the current just like infrastructure is basically a model that allows shared liquidity. So tapping into liquidity across pairs through this like single shared liquidity. This is what we call like a shared liquidity layer. And so you can think of a shared liquidity layer, which has two portions. There's a, we call like a cushion, like a liquidity cushion or a buffer. And then there's the like market making vaults. They're the only place that an LP can deposit is into the market making vaults. The purpose of this like buffer or cushion is to basically minimize the impact of like volatile trader P&L on LPs. So they don't see like, you know, huge, there's some way to cushion that sort of impact.
So this is like the which purpose eventually, of an AMM, right?
Correct. I mean, there's
it's
actually
an AMM because
like,
there's no price.
There's some infighting around the nomenclature, actually, like even internally, I've been like
some linguistics.
It's okay. Called an Oracle per-based AMM. Like it's not properly an AMM. So unresolved, actually, here we get to another linguistic question. Unresolved terminology discussion, but generally the way this model has been like referred to, I think, in the literature,
like shared liquidity
to whatever degree it exists, is like an Oracle-based like perpetuals, Oracle pool-based perpetuals AMM or something. It's some ridiculous acronym that no one ever uses. It's like Obama or something. It's like not it.
Almost Obama.
So it's like, exactly. Ticker's Obama. But yeah, so that is the high level model, and the way the liquidity that supports the functioning of that system is what we call this like shared liquidity layer, which has those two portions that I described. There's this like buffer or sort of like liquidity cushion, which is supposed to, which like accrues value if and when traders lose money, and also it's reduced in value if and when traders make money. So it absorbs some of that volatility in P&L that it doesn't directly impact LPs, and LPs are programmatically rewarded with or just like programmatically gain route. The fees are routed directly to LPs as a sort of risk adjusted means of or a way for them to benefit from basically being potentially the counterparty or basically market making for extending taker liquidity to traders. So 100% of liquidation fees, and then the majority of trading, or more than 50% of trading fees, are routed directly to LPs. Like programmatically through the system. So you can think of LPs as basically LPs in what is a market making vault. So the reason I say market making is not because someone's actually running a market making strategy, but you can effectively think of, if you're depositing into a pool and you're extending like taker liquidity to anyone who wants to come in at that Oracle price, you're basically acting as a market maker. So you're extending your liquidity to any takers on the other side across any of the assets. It's all denominated in USDC. The reason for that is that we don't want like wrong way risk as far as like, you know, there's additional risk that's introduced if the underlying collateral is highly volatile. So everything is settled in USDC and denominated in USDC. And then both on the trader side and on the LP side, and LPs into the market making vaults effectively like extend that liquidity and are rewarded through a share of trading fees, with the caveat that basically there's this additional layer, this like buffer or cushion, that absorbs like any losses or gains, and in theory like grows over time to minimize the like the risk that LPs need to act as like direct settlers of trades. Hopefully that makes sense.
It totally does. Totally does. Just a clarification for me is, at time T0, does the liquidity buffer starts at just zero, or is there like initial, like you pull some from the market making vault to put into it first so that there's something there?
Great question.
Or does it start at zero?
Great question. So at T0, the buffer is not full. So the purpose of the market making vault is twofold. So it is initially to act as that market maker. So as trading begins, it's like that sort of cold start problem of and when before sort of the buffer begins to build up. The entire system works without the existence of any capital in the cushion. The idea is that over time, it becomes increasingly attractive in the sense that cushion grows in value, and the relative like risk or the likelihood or frequency of like LPs directly settling trades goes down over time. That's a correct interpretation.
Okay. I think that's a very key point that, you know, you just glossed over and I want to emphasize and double click on that is as this buffer gets thicker and thicker and thicker, every subsequent LP dollars that come in is drastically reduced in risk because those dollars, like correct. Any loss got to go through those dollars first before they hurt my dollar. So it acts as like this, you know, perpetual liquidity vacuum. As more people are going to, people are going to really want to keep on depositing. Like, and you know, on the other side though, let's walk through like a journey.
If can I say one thing? I just want to make sure.
Please.
You're being 100% correct. So it's not that each additional LP is more safe than the last one. It's not that like the first LPs get wrecked before the other ones do. That would be a bad system. It's that there are you can think of it, there's just basically two tranches. So there is the buffer or cushion, which as it grows over time, that risk to anybody who is an LP in the market vault goes down, but it's equally socialized across any LP. It's not like if you LP'd, you know, tomorrow versus someone who LP'd 10 days later, you have different risk if in 12 days there is some triggers blow through for whatever reason, like the cushion or something. You're equally exposed. But it's simply that over time, the buffer then, the probability that the buffer grows in value increases as there is additional trading. And so that acts as a buffer to LPs, but it's not that one LP is different than the other LP.
Yeah, I get it. There's positive drift in the buffer. Yes. But I just want to click on this point though, because I, from my analysis of it, I still feel that the earlier LPs took on that initial risk because the buffer started at zero. So like it could have hit me like right away, but because I was in early, I was in at day one, I was able to accrue this buffer. But Dave comes in at day 10, and now he gets the benefit of the buffer that I had worked so hard, or I mean, I had put my capital at risk to kind of earn that buffer, but Dave's going to get the same protection as I do.
So this is a great point, and this is exactly why we have our current sort of system, which is through August 1st or through, and then there'll be various phases, but initially there is beneficial conversion between USDC and OLP. So typically if you were to deposit 100 USDC, and you would receive 100 LP tokens, the relative conversion is increased in the beginning to make up for this fact that there is no buffer in the beginning. And so right now, the current structure is that there's a, like a 16% boost, which is like prorated for a year. So if you were to deposit and lock for a year, you would get 116 OLP tokens. If you were to deposit for 6 months, you would get 108. And so that relative conversion rate is improve for those who are depositing in the beginning, and that will go down eventually towards zero over time. So that is the way to make up for the fact that, yes, you are putting your capital at risk, but the relative distribution of trading fees and liquidation rewards that is distributed to all LPs is heavily skewed towards those who deposit early and lock their capital.
Right, because of the 16% boost. Right, got it.
Exactly.
Understood. Great. It's kind of like I teed you up for that answer. Totally not. But yeah,
it was almost like I was like, I have the answer for you. It's a great question. I have the answer for you. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, Dave, you want to hit the next one?
The next one. So when it comes to just scaling an RWA perp dex like Ostium, what are the challenges and unresolved problems you face?
Yeah, this is a great question. Man, I mean, I think the thing that keeps me up at night the most is like the onboarding experience. Chow from Alliance, I think it was Chow or Imran. I should know who just posted this. It was the other night, had a great post of like, you know, I spent 10 minutes going through the on-ramping experience through different wallets on, you know, using three different on-ramping providers. And here's the average time it took me and here was my conversion rate. And it's getting better, but it still sucks. And if you want any shot of onboarding users who are not using a wallet today, this needs to be seamless.
What do you think of Infinex?
Isn't there yet. I mean, I'm really excited to like test the product. I like deposited into it. I totally follow all the, you know, various campaigns. Like I've totally deposited and I'm playing all the games that they are incredible at like roping people into playing. So I deposited the speedrun. I'm doing the great run. They've done an incredible job on go to market that I can only say like, you know, bowing down to Kane and everyone who's been working on it. I think the vision is incredibly promising. I think definitely right now the existing user base of depositors is almost certainly all heavy DeFi users and probably not any normies, but that'll, I also hate that term generally, just normal people who don't have a wallet. But maybe, yeah, maybe they'll be the ones to unlock that and to change that. I think it's still unclear to me whether they're going to, they want to be like the, they say they're the UX layer, whether like the go-to-market at some point will go after like some very specific application or some very specific use case for non-crypto people, like what exactly it is going to be that they're going to want to buy. Is it that like they're going to want to use Infinex to onboard to buy some yield bearing asset that they can't, you know, that's like,
they're going to want to buy
Solidity that are yielding what they get in their bank. Yeah. Or it's, I think it's like they spend like all, it's all around sort of this like layer and this like onboarding experience, like using passkeys and stuff. But the core, like what is the core product? Like what is the actual core product beyond like, I don't know, maybe savings or something that will attract people to use it? I still don't entirely know. And maybe that's like intentionally vague, or maybe I just need to like reread the documentation again. Maybe it's been updated. Yeah, I mean, they've done an incredible job in go to market. I totally believe in the vision. I just don't, the product, the specific product that you would want to get your friend to use who doesn't use crypto is not clear to me. Like they, I don't know what
you're selling. I mean, do you see normal people using a product like Infinex anyway?
Well, it depends on what it is. My point is like, I don't know what the product is yet. It's like, I see it as like it's like the onboarding process. I get it. I think it was like very smooth. But I don't know what the product is yet that will convert someone. But maybe that's not the point of it. I would say on our side, like
they build a bridge with nothing on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. They built like a really nice, you know, really nice bridge. But I'm they're all legends, and I'm sure I'll be, you know, I think we'll all find out over the next few weeks and months. What I was going to say is like, our focus has been more on, sort of, I guess the inverse, which, is thinking about like, what is the core set of users that is not on chain today, that is not doing stuff on chain today that we think is most proximate to potentially like behaviorally, culturally, whatever, to on-chain users. And this is sort of like FX or consumer or retail, like FX trading. And when I say FX trading, like those platforms usually have a combination of usually thousands of assets. Like they have not only FX sort of majors and many miners and cross pairs, they also have like, you know, metals and energy, all the sorts of stuff that we have just at a much larger scale. There's a huge, you know, there's like tens of millions of daily or weekly active users around the world who are on these platforms. Behaviorally, those platforms have actually in many ways like similar user acquisition strategies through like Telegram channels often, KOLs, et cetera. And the user behavior is very analogous to perps traders, or at least to like crypto traders more generally, but just on different assets. We see that as like a non-crypto native user base that is ripe for conversion and a potential like, and I've never seen a DeFi protocol make any explicit overtures to that user base or deliberately go after the distribution channels and the sort of like types of assets that user is interested in, rather than trying to convert them to like trade more crypto. Just like put the assets that they like and put them on chain and sell them on the fact that, well, this is actually now, you can actually self-custody this. Like you get the benefits of crypto without, you can trade those assets if you want, but you can trade all the assets that you typically like trading, but you can do that in a self-custodial way from, you know, your own wallet. There's the trade-off obviously between, if you do it in a self-custodial way, then you have to deal with keys. But I think with, you know, the Coinbase smart wallet and other wallet innovations, et cetera, we're getting to a point where you can hopefully get the best of both worlds. We're not entirely there, but we're getting there. That's sort of how we've approached it. Like where does the space need to go? Like these assets will move on chain. We actually think that this like perps first approach makes more sense and is going to better suit the existing user base on chain. And also we think there's this like huge user base that's not on chain today that is spread out across these many like trading platforms that is ripe for conversion. And so really focusing on like the product. And then I think those users will tell us what is like, you know, I mean, it's, I think a lot of it is like pretty evident. Like people don't want to necessarily, they want some smart wallet integration, or there needs to be some easy bridge integration, or, you know, those, but the specific, that onboarding experience needs to be seamless, but the specific way in which the onboarding experience should be adapted, I think, is a function of like the product itself rather than like a general purpose onboarding experience, which is, I think, just to tie it back to what you had discussed earlier, is I think we're like how maybe Infinex has like thought about the,
got it,
the problem.
Yeah.
So just a, I would say like a reverse approach.
And so with Ostium, well, with any perp markets, there's like three different elements that go. There's the traders, the spot price, and the funding rate. Ostium has a velocity-based funding rate system. How exactly does a velocity-based funding rate system work? And you can give a high-level overview of that.
Sure. So a velocity-based system just means that it takes into account the like prior imbalance. So you can just, I'll just give you an example for like why this matters. So imagine you know, your funding rate is based on, and just to be clear, like in this pull-based model, the funding rate is based on the input value is like the skew between long and short, not the drift of the price of the perp away from spot, which is different from how funding rate would be calculated on like an order book model. So if that is the case, right, like imagine now someone wants to come in and collect funding, they want to farm the funding rate. So they're going to, they want to collect, you know, the funding on oil, and they want to hedge themselves in the underlying market to stay, you know, delta neutral or approximate some level of neutrality. And now they come in and they close out the imbalance, and now their funding rate goes to zero. That would be bad. You want to account for the prior existing, you know, if the imbalance existed for some period of time, you need to then account for the basically it's like an integral of the prior imbalance, so that you don't, otherwise you have this like adverse mechanism where you're incentivizing people to close some of the imbalance, but never to fully close it. Because if they fully close it, then it goes to zero. So it just is a way of accounting for, yeah, it's just a way of accounting for the prior imbalance. You basically do like an integral of the time and the amount of that imbalance.
And so right now you said deposits are in native USDC on Arbitrum. Are there plans in the future to have interest-bearing assets such as SDAI, SRAX, for traders to deposit in the future?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're still early days, but definitely this is something that we're still early, guys. I mean, we want, but like the community will decide. And like, you know, the community will decide. This should be what people want to deposit is, you know, people will tell us, or will tell the protocol. So, that's definitely something we thought about. I think everything is going in this direction. This is actually one of the, I think people underestimate, I'll just say, I'm on a lot of panels. People talk a lot about like yield bearing stable coins in the context of tokenization. It's the only thing that people talk about. And I'm like, you know, always trying to shift the conversation to like more on the trading side, because like right now everyone just thinks like RWAs and tokenization is like literally just tokenizing treasuries. Which is like so much more than that, but I digress. So people definitely talk about it a lot, but I think the like, I don't think people realize like how novel it is to be able to use an interest-bearing asset as your collateral for doing stuff. Like if you go and you take your dollars and you go and use them as collateral on something, like they're not naturally earning yield in a way that is like offsetting the cost of the interest that you have to pay. That is genuinely a novel unlock. And I think this is like the direction that the space is going, and is definitely a direction that I think is very, it makes a ton of sense for anybody that's building a protocol like ours, or just in DeFi more generally. But today at Genesis USDC, native USDC is the only form of accepted collateral, but that will certainly change.
It's all good. So you got to start with the vanilla flavor, and then you add the cookies and creams and the rocky roads like later down the road, right? You can't go chunky monkey day one. That's just a little crazy, you know? So you got to start a little nice.
That's exactly how I was going to say it.
Yeah.
That was good.
Kate, you're really one with words.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm learning. This is a linguist class, you know? So this whole time you've been paying
attention. Another linguist podcast, honestly. Yeah.
But okay,
oh my God.
But back to business for a second. I've never really traded Forex and such, but from what my general research, I would love for you to kind of, you know, bust this myth. I heard that people when trade Forex, they do it on extreme leverage, because frankly, things just don't move a lot in Forex, right? So does that mean that when a trader gets in a position on Ostium, there needs to be like an LP that can absorb that size, or do you guys have like a cap on like the max trade size, or any insights on
that? That's an excellent question. So I do want to say yes, that is true for FX, and you'd be shocked, honestly. Like, this is what I was saying about some of the behavioral and just like cultural overlaps, I guess, between these like FX platforms and a lot of like crypto platforms, you wouldn't believe, like even for a crypto person, like you would not believe actually how much leverage a lot of these platforms allow. Like it's often so like the default, that is like what is default set to, and you have to adjust the parameters and adjust the settings to reduce it. So there's some pretty crazy stuff in FX. In terms of your question, so excellent intuition, and the answer is yes. There have to be open interest caps. You can't just have unlimited open interest on every asset. And so, and the way those cap, the way open interest is calculated is obviously the collateral times the leverage is the total notional position size. So yes, it does account for leverage. I will say the leverage levels would not be 2000x, but they are
not yet.
substantive, but I don't think a on-chain native, more disintermediated platform. I think the reason a lot of those platforms, those like off-chain platforms, can offer leverage that's so high is because if things go to shit, they could just close people's positions. And that's like usually in the end is like why people churn, because something like that happens to them. They bore the brunt of some poor risk management decision that the exchange made. And so it's very, very, very important to us that the whole reason that we're building this is to have a system where we can't meddle. There is no ability to meddle in individual trades and to, you know, arbitrarily block people out and close their positions and prevent them from withdrawing. Which is, you know, in some cases, depending on exchange, can be rampant in that underlying market, especially on the sort of consumer side. So we don't want that. I don't think anybody should want
got
that.
It. Okay,
you want to build with the DeFi principles in mind.
Yeah, no, it's just unclear. You're saying that on the Web2 platforms, if there is, you know, one bad trade that just took down the market, the platform would shut down my position, which is still all good, so that they can balance out the books. And
it's a really good nitty-gritty that you're getting into. So not precisely. What I'm saying is many of the platforms, in order to attract users, they will allow things like 2000x leverage or like guaranteed stop losses that at the limit, in like 99% of cases, are fine, and people, like, it doesn't pose an existential risk to the platform, but in some cases will result in like massive losses. So let me actually give like a little bit more context, because you guys might find this interesting. I wrote a short, actually wrote this, like started writing this like at Rob A at ECC at like 3 a.m. and like wrote it in the taxi.
This is when
like,
I met you.
Yes, like literally. I was like, I'm really tired because I was
You didn't even introduce form, yourself. Like, you were like, hey, I wrote this at like 3 a.m. at Rob A.
Yeah, I'm a little crazy. So anyways, we're all a little crazy. That's why we're here. Asia, you can share this in the show notes, but what I sort of try to describe, and I'll maybe try to summarize here again, is that the fundamental structure of many of these like consumer trading platforms is that they are the counterparty to traders. So there's no incentive towards balance between long and short. There's no free floating price. You can think of it as a perp. It's like, how do I put this? It is literally a pool-based perp without a funding rate. So there's usually some overnight fee that you have to pay off if you hold your position longer than 5 days. It depends on the platform. Some of them will have like, you know, accounts where there's no overnight fee for less than 5 days of holding. But if you hold it any more than 5 days, you're paying some percentage in your position. But critically, it is not a function of the imbalance. It's usually a function of the interest rate. It's not a function of the skew between long and short. And so what that means is that when traders can come in, so the platform is basically acting. So the market making vault, going back to the whole Ostium, you know, liquidity layer, right? The market making vault, where what LPs are extending that taker liquidity in these traditional Web2 platforms, they are extending that liquidity from their own book, from their own balance sheet. And there is no natural incentive for someone else to come in and balance out the open interest, because there's nothing like a funding rate. And so people can take on effectively unlimited directional risk on gold or whatever. And then they have risk management systems where they have some algorithms, but a lot of it is shockingly manual. It'd be shocked at how manual it is. They're manually looking at the book and saying, oh shit, we're like really, 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 really long gold right now. And like, this is probably not good and we might need to hedge ourselves. Or, you know, we're really long gold and there's this like one guy who's like responsible for 50% of the open interest, and like, maybe he knows something and this is sketchy and we're going to auto deleverage him and close his position. And like, they have, that is well within their rights to do. Like, they are allowed to do that and they do that.
Okay.
And there's sort of two models for how they manage risk. There's like A book and B book. If you're an A book, you basically, in theory, you hedge everything. I'm going to be honest with you. Like in most cases, they're actually, you know, they're not necessarily hedging every trade. They're not like, you know, I got this like 500K long position on gold, routing that directly to some liquidity provider. There may be the batching transactions, and that might be on an hourly basis or maybe minute basis. There's different levels of granularity depending on how much they're A booking things. And then there's B book, mm-hmm. which is like pure our own balance sheet. We're just betting on traders losing money. And most of them are sort of some combination. There's like some hybrid. But what that means is that like, even if you're hybrid in any way, because there's no funding rate, this is like why I'm so, like, such a nerd about funding rates. Like funding rates are the 0 to 1 that makes this like weird sort of, bastard model of like this combination of this synthetic trading model from the traditional markets and this like, perp model or this like concept of a perp that Shiller wrote about in the 80s, like makes this actually possible. Like the funding rate makes that possible because it creates an incentive for balance. And it effectively allows you, it makes possible a non-custodial model because otherwise, like, there's an incentive for others to come in and balance out the system and for anybody to come in and act as an LP rather than some sophisticated platform acting in like a black box to try to manually manage risk with no external mm-hmm. fee structure to incentivize that sort of balance.
Got it.
Yeah. I didn't remember the original question.
No, I love that.
Did yeah. markets exist before BitMEX?
So they didn't, but BitMEX, people like usually don't know that. Like, So BitMEX and like obviously Arthur like popularized and made or like made perps a reality, but he didn't come up with the idea. Not to discredit him or anything, he made it real and he created this entire market that we have today that dominates the space, and is like the real, in my opinion, like 0 to 1 primitive. But perps were first written about by Shiller in like the 1980s. So mm-hmm. if you look up. Shiller the Economist and look up perpetuals, and he'd conceived of this idea. A lot of the, I think something that I love about crypto, or just like love about DeFi that is so beautiful, is that a lot of these like libertarian or sort of like Austrian economist ideas about how you might be able to construct a market can be tested and experimented with in real time in this beautiful experimental ground where things, some things blow up and some things go very poorly and some people get hurt, but also there's incredible innovation and just new primitives. And it's so like, it is truly, I think it's like so beautiful. AMMs and like, writing about an AMM and like a Reddit post and like in a blog post and, Hayden and others like making that a reality is so cool. Taking these like theoretical concepts about market structures, and perps are a great example. They were a theoretical concept that like Shiller had first written about, for how you might be able to construct like a non-expiring or like a never expiring future that was turned into a reality. So they have a long theoretical history, but a shorter, much shorter practical history.
Interesting. Very cool. That's like a lot of cryptography papers too. They're like written about in the 70s, 80s, and they aren't put into practice until decades later.
Yeah. I'm less of like a pure, transparently like a markets nerd than I am a cryptography nerd, but definitely I think over time I'll spend more time digging into some of those papers and more in the direction that you alluded to. But yeah, there's a lot. It's very true. I think both on the markets and financial primitive side and also the cryptography side, there's a lot of theoretical ideas that are only finally been like put into practice in the last 5 or so years.
And now getting back to Ostium, what do you guys have on your roadmap? What should users look out for? And should users expect to be blessed with a responsibility in overseeing the protocol in the future?
Okay. No comment on the last question beyond, just having, we don't want to operate something as a centralized entity. I mean, that's not the vision for what this is. And as all the stuff that I described about the market failures in the traditional markets are like, we really, really want to change. And I think the only way to have that happen is through like a trustless or trust minimized, like on-chain system. So I'll just say that, in terms of on what's on the docket and what's on the roadmap. Lots of exciting stuff. The full trading, full system launch, all engines fire is happening in very, very short order in the next several weeks. So depending on when this podcast actually comes out, might already be live or not.
Pumped.
And then in the lead up to that, and also afterwards, we'll be announcing or just expanding on, I think, some more of our partnerships. Our most important strategic partners are obviously Arbitrum, but also Chainlink on some of the data feed side on the crypto side, and then Stork on the other Oracle side. Gelato for a lot of the management of the liquidation engine, which I didn't even talk about, but this is another part where I think we've thought very seriously about sort of decentralization and disintermediation.
How does Gelato manage the liquidation engine?
So as opposed to what is like sort of standards that like a DEX manages all like liquidations and like conditional orders entirely in-house in the beginning and then eventually open sources that bot to the community and like maybe no one really runs it. Maybe some people run it at some point. We didn't want to do that. And so Gelato, their network, they have what they call functions, what is very similar to what like Chainlink calls automations, allows custom off-chain code to run. And you can basically have them either run the primary instance or backup instance of the set of the keeper network that manages take profits, stop losses, liquidations, and all of those core orders and triggers, keeps track of them, triggers, and like executes them. So they're a very important partner for maintaining that engine and doing that in a disintermediated and decentralized way from day one.
So, the OG Gelato before the rocks.
Awesome. Anyways, what I was going to say is all of those partners are really, really critical. And I'm sorry, I didn't even mention Chaos Labs. They're incredible. And they sort of do all the risk management. Again, another source of disintermediation from day one. They worked with us very closely on the mech design. We work with them very closely. We, you know, like basically co-worked in their office for like 4 months last year. So they're very close to us. We work very closely with them. And all of the news, I guess, on that those partnerships we'll be sharing more about exactly how those will evolve going into mainnet over the next couple of weeks. So, yeah.
Awesome. We love to hear
it. I do have one last one question. Yeah, I got one more. I'm just very curious. Sorry, just this last one. I'm like, how are you thinking of kind of going to market and finding your first set of like, you know, 1,000 DAUs, right?
Like, oh my God, I feel like this is what keeps me up at night. Like, I think I've concluded if you don't know who your first 100 true fans are, they don't exist. I think that is like literally the hardest. It's, I think of like go to market, there's two, you know, I'm learning this all on the fly. So, you know, I'm no expert. We're all figuring this out, but it's like, there's the external, like max reach, like talk to as many people, evangelize content, blah, 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 get distribution. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the one-on-one, like mic glove, really talking to people, figuring out what they care about, like having that influence your product roadmap. And I think we've done, I at least in the next coming weeks, I'm trying to shift a little bit more of my energy towards the latter. Or like really double down on the ladder, because that white glove onboarding, like I've learned more from setting up a call, like a 15-minute call with a testnet user and being like, okay, go back on the testnet, open up a fresh wallet, try to like, you know, get free tokens so you can start trading easily on testnet, try the onboarding flow, what is not working, what's bugging, and like seeing exactly what they care, where does their eye gravitate, like where does their mouse move. That has been so incredibly useful for us in the product iteration process. And so we'll be doing a lot more of that. I would say to anybody listening to this, if you want to try the platform, if you want to be an early user, if you want to be involved in some way, if you want to be part of the community, you're excited about what we're building, please, please, please reach out to me, send me a DM, message us on Twitter, either me individually, which is just at Calidora, I'm at Calidora everywhere, or at Austin Labs. I will do get some like spam DMs, but I'll do my very best to answer everybody. And if I haven't answered, just feel free to ping me again. Don't just bump me as many times as you need to. And we really want to work with you, and we want you to be a part of the early users that influence the direction of the product. So,
And we have one last lightning round question that we ask all our guests.
Okay.
So who would you recommend as a guest? Who do you want to see on Flywheel?
Oof, my God, you didn't warn me about this question.
It's a surprise.
It's called a lightning.
It is a surprise. No, I mean, lightning also, doesn't warn you. This was all pretty unscripted. This was all pretty surprised.
It's what we do best.
It is. Oh my God. I have Omer on from Chaos, if you haven't had him on yet. You should definitely have Omer on. He's the Omer founder of Chaos Labs. Okay. Yeah. He's incredible. I'm sure he'll have a lot to say.
Noted.
I mean, yeah. Noted. You should definitely have them on. I have a lightning round question for you guys on the linguistics
team. Oh, shit. Okay.
Sure. Reverse lightning.
Reverse lightning.
Reverse lightning. What do you think is the linguistic origin of the word pedigree?
Oh, that's a good one. Is it French?
Yes. What does it mean?
No.
It's like pedigree. So like I'm thinking of like degrees, so like measuring something. I feel like there's like some link between degrees and pedigree and like petty. So
that's like, a really good guess. Like, that's a really, really good guess, but it's wrong. Think more about the first part. Like petty.
Like pediatrician, so like something with children, like children or something.
You're so funny.
I think differently. I think it's since it's pedicure, I think a pedicure is under your fingers? Feet, so everything comes underneath you. Like your pedicure, good. Things that come after you because it's under my feet, you know.
Good. Okay. All right. Excellent direction. Type. You guys are both like, the degree idea was a good one, but unfortunately not correct. So pedigree comes from pied de grue, which is foot of a goose. And it is basically like the, when you draw out a family tree and you know, the Habsburg line or something, it looks like a goose's foot. Yeah, that's wow. The
okay.
That's good the there. History of that word. Yeah. I should bring a new linguistic tidbit to any podcast.
We'll save the rest for the linguistics podcast. Kyle Doerr, thank you so much for coming on. Hope to see you soon.
Thanks, guys. This was fun.
Talk soon.
Talk soon. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Post Game Show. I'm your host, DeFi Dave, here with capital K, Kit, as always. And we are just wrapping up a phenomenal episode with Caladora from Ostium, the ballerina, the linguistic, the Renaissance woman. I have to say, it was so fitting for her background to be that Renaissance painting in whatever room that she was in, because that basically really perfectly described like her aura and her background and her intellect. You can tell her like mind is always going. And it's funny, before this podcast, I had like a few people shout out Gabe from Show Research. It was like, yo, like, look at this. You better have this person on. And I'm just like, okay, like I'll keep an eye out. And then I met Caladora during ECC in Brussels. And I'm just like, okay, like let's have her on. And she did not disappoint. I was really impressed. I was impressed when I was doing the research for this podcast. I thought it was interesting, like how interdisciplinary this whole thing is, like whether it's like it includes like perp dexes, RWAs, being on chain, like all that shit, all into one. And she just explained, we went deep in this one. This was definitely like an advanced podcast. Kit, what are your thoughts?
Okay, I'm gonna do some bad and then the good. The bad for me in this is that
the bad,
who is this product for right now? Because I understand that she sees the future vision of like all these assets being traded on chain. I'm with her 100%. But we live today and tomorrow, and who are these users that are going to come in and trade, you know, live cattle or lean hogs on the blockchain today, right now, right? And I don't think they're going to be adding on other crypto assets, because that kind of go against their whole thesis. So how are they going to get that initial bucket of users to come in? That's just like my one bad element. The good is the tech and the architecture, very elegant designed, very robust. And to do all this basically before mainnet is even live, right? And they're just so focused already on making sure the product is this good is, I think, really impressive.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not sure if the users are on chain yet. I feel like they're future users on chain, and that's their bet. That's their bet, and no pun intended. And we'll see if they come on chain,
right?
Because I really think this is a novel product. Whether it, like if you compare it to other perp dexes or even centralized perp venues, this is quite novel. What they have created, the engine that they've created, and so I think that's what really gives it a chance. So you know, we'll see if they come online, if they come on chain. Is there like a point of the interview that stood out to you?
Oh man, multiple points. I think a lot of like her background really just caught me off guard. And I love that she was so open and she went so deep about her background. And, you know, she kind of did this whole trip, like, you know, tour de force. And then she kind of arrived at this specific thing that she wanted to solve. So I thought that was like a really cool story to hear someone from such a, you know, literally not finance, not tech, like so far removed from the usual cut of the cloth. Like, I love seeing that. I love like a person like that can come here and thrive.
She's about the grind, and I respect the fuck out of that. Like grinding, being a ballerina for 20 plus years, going back to college, sleeping in a dorm at 23. That's hard too. Then like living in a hacker house after that. Like Caladora is built different.
Right.
Straight.
Right.
That's just simple. She's just built different. And so I expect big things coming in the future. And for all the big things on Flywheel, make sure you go ahead, hit that bell button, give us a like, subscribe right now, leave us a comment, let us know what you think. Follow us on all of our socials at Flywheel DeFi on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22.
You can follow me at 0xCapital_K.
And we'll see you next week. Everything said on this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.